This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. Coming up, two Upjohn Institute economists look at whether the Affordable Care Act is forcing some workers into part-time hours. But first, being a caregiver for someone who's terminally ill or has a long-term illness can be exhausting. Joyce Rupp says both family caregivers and those who do the work professionally need to find a balance and care for themselves, too. Rupp will be the main speaker at this year's 15th Annual Community of Caregivers at the Transformations Spirituality Center in Kalamazoo. She spoke with WMUK's Andy Robbins.
What are the different challenges, perhaps, that face someone who is giving care to, you know, someone who has Alzheimer's or perhaps a terminal illness or some sort of disability? Are there differences in the challenges that face someone who is a professional versus a non-professional?
You know, I think there is a difference, Andy. I mean, there are a lot of similarities too. But the individuals who are caregivers, let's say for an elderly parent or a spouse who has Alzheimer's or dementia, or parents who have children with physical, mental, emotional challenges. There are so many varieties of caregivers today of individuals who aren't, quote, hired professionally to care for others. And I think in some ways, there's a pressure on people who are professional in the sense that this is their job, and many times they are asked to, I'm thinking of nurses right now and the long hours they have in hospitals, and I think their work is just such an impossibility, and they're constantly telling me that, you know, they would love to stand by the bedside or sit by the bedside and really listen to a patient who wants to talk about their life and their issues, and they just simply can't do it. I mean, they have to move on. So I think that's different than a person who's caring individually for someone else. There's a different relationship there. Sometimes I think it means that they even care more. They take on more suffering onto themselves because they care so much about that person. Another area I think for individual caregivers is that many times they don't know when to. They either don't know when to ask for help or to get some more help, or else they just want so much to try and do that all by themselves. I'll just give you an example of that. This past year, I was with a woman who was dying of lung cancer, and her son had chosen to be the central caregiver for her. His siblings lived out of town, and so he himself is a professional person. He had two jobs, not with caregiving, but two professional jobs that he had. He had teenagers, and he moved in with his mother to take care of her the last 4 or 5 months, and he wanted to do it all himself. And her friends were there, and they were trying to help out when they could. He got so overwhelmed, just absolutely overwhelmed, couldn't do his work, professional work well, didn't have enough time for his kids, loved his mom greatly, wanted to be there every moment with her. And one day he just exploded. He just got furious with the people who were there also trying to help. And it was because his load was just so great. And out of that whole experience, he realized that he just couldn't do it by himself. But it was a very painful experience for him and for the people who were involved in that. So I think professionally, there are more guidelines there. But what I find with professional caregivers is that they are so oriented into caring for other people that they really do, they either forget to care, they don't have time to care for themselves. I mean, a professional caregiver still has home responsibilities. They've got their own life to take care of. They've got their own relationships. And I found that they either tend to ignore their own personal hurt and stress, or sometimes they're just in denial about it. They just simply can't allow themselves to know how much they're hurting.
Are there some specific things that you find that caregivers don't do to, you know, care for themselves while they're trying to care for this other person that that the, you know, they can adopt that, you know, makes that load lighter?
Mm-hmm. Yes, I'm thinking specifically of a former publisher of mine, and his wife was 60 when she developed Alzheimer's. And he quit his position, and he wanted to keep her at home, and he has for 12 years. But he's a remarkable man. And at first, same thing, he wanted to just care for her himself. But as her disease progressed, he realized two things. One is that he needed to debrief someplace. That constant every single day was just really tough. And so he joined a men's group, a wonderful supportive men's group. The other thing he did is he went seeking help. He got some daycare. He took his wife to a daycare a couple of days a week, and then eventually now at this point in her last stages, he has help coming into the home, professional help coming in. The other thing that he has been really faithful about is his own personal care, I guess, in the sense that, you know, he's continuing to take time out for quiet for himself, for his own reading and whatever it is, that exercise, things that will help him, you know, to maintain some kind of balance in that. So one of the first things I find that people give up is any time for themselves. They're just constantly at the beck and call of another person. And so how to say, you know, I need to go away for a while. I need to have somebody come in and take care of so-and-so so I can just get out of the house, so I can just do some shopping and not feel guilty about it. I remember my sister, when my brother-in-law had Parkinson, she wouldn't even leave the house to go get groceries. I mean, it was so demanding, and she just wanted to be there every moment. So I think they don't even take that physical time for themselves. I think that's one big thing. Getting enough sleep is another. A lot of times, you know, they're awakened in the night, and so, again, trying to take care of that piece, because when a person doesn't get enough sleep, that's when they really start, you know, giving in to some of the less healthy ways to respond, so to speak, you know, and that's anger and irritation and blaming other people and those sorts of things that can happen for them.
For people who are caring for a loved one or relative at home in particular, do they feel guilt when, you know, they need to take time for themselves, but that's a problem?
Oh, guilt is a really big thing. Yes, I would say that's central. Oh, I feel so guilty. I should be here at every moment. Oh, what if I leave? What if so-and-so would die while I'm gone? You know, just that buildup of guilt that's there. And underneath that is, you know, feeling so responsible, taking on that whole area. Another aspect of that is feeling like they're the ones that, you know, if there was someone who's maybe not terminally ill, feeling that they're responsible to, quote, fix that person, you know, whatever that might be. And you know, anyone professional, when we talk about compassion and self-compassion, it's like that fixing thing or being ultra-responsible can really get people in trouble.
Now, you come at this, obviously, from a spiritual stance. You're a member of a Catholic mm-hmm. order, the Servants of Mary. Are there differences, you know, if you're coming at it from that viewpoint versus someone who is perhaps not especially religious?
Oh, that's such a good question. You know, one of the things I spend time on, and I will do this with the professional caregivers, is that because the majority of them will be coming out of some kind of Christian background, they might not be, you know, active in their religion, but the majority of people are, and in interfaith, other religions as well, there's such a strong message of sacrificing for others, ultra generosity, giving up your life for another. And so when I talk out of my own tradition, which is Christian, I ask people I just kind of take them through some of the ways that I see Jesus as being self-compassionate. You know, he constantly, in all of the Christian scriptures, they show him going away by himself, spending evenings alone, taking time to recuperate, to pray, to draw spiritual strength to go on with his journey. They show him being in touch with his emotions and crying, weeping when his friend Lazarus dies. They describe him, and this is a big one, I think, you know, he takes time for social relationships, his friendship with Mary, Martha, and Lazarus. You know, that's one of the things that for both groups, but a particular individual caregivers, they just kind of cut off all their social relationships outside of the home when they're, you know, in a difficult situation of caregiving. And I think another big one is that when Jesus is in his agony before his death, I mean, in the Garden of Olives, he asks for help. He goes deliberately and says to his followers, "Would you watch with me? This is a really tough time for me." So I always talk about that because I myself have yet to hear any minister or pastor emphasize being compassionate for ourselves. It's always about being there for other people, and I just think we need to get a balance on that. You know, both are really essential. Well, you know, one of the things I want to say, because I think people really mix this up when talk about self-compassion, is that, you know, it's not narcissism, it's not self-orientation, it's really about self-love and self-respect, and it's about being kind to ourselves. And you know, contrary to what people believe, I think the majority of people are not very kind to themselves. You know, as soon as something happens that they wish they hadn't done or didn't happen, interiorly we just start calling each other names like, "Oh, idiot," or "You're so irresponsible," or, "You know, you can't get that straight," or "You're not," whatever. And so I just think and so many writers now will say this, is that, you know, the more compassion we have for ourselves, the kinder we are for ourselves, the kinder we're going to be with other people. And I found that to be so true for myself. And I will share, you know, some stories of myself, my own experience of this as I go through the evening and the day with the ones that will be present there.
We've been speaking with Joyce Rupp, who is going to be the keynote speaker this year for the Community of Caregivers, a 15th annual gathering at Transformations in Kalamazoo. Joyce, thanks so much for being with us.
You're welcome, Andy. I'm just so glad that we had some time to talk about this. You can probably tell that it's one of my favorite subjects, so thank you.
Joyce Rupp is a nationally known speaker and author. She spoke with WMUK's Andy Robbins. Rupp will speak at two events during the 15th Annual Community of Caregivers Gathering in Kalamazoo. Tonight, she'll talk about caring from the heart for personal caregivers at 7 o'clock. And on Saturday, she'll address professional caregivers about the gift of self-compassion from 9 a.m. to 4 p.m. Both events are at the Transformations Spirituality Center on Gull Road. You can find more information through a link on our webpage at WMUK.org. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. The Federal Affordable Care Act has been controversial for its potential impact on healthcare and also on the economy. A report from the Upjohn Institute for Employment Research in Kalamazoo examines whether the act, also known as Obamacare, is pushing some workers out of full-time jobs into working part-time hours. Susan Hausman and Marcus Dillander are economists with the Upjohn Institute and two of the three authors of the report on the ACA's impact on part-time work. Thank you both for being here.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks for having us.
So why exactly did you want to focus on part-time work? What is the potential problem here?
Well, maybe for your listeners, we should step back a little bit and just remind them of some of the main components of the Affordable Care Act, the ACA as we call it. You know, it came with an individual mandate. That is, people were required to purchase health care insurance if they didn't have it. Medicaid expansion, there were subsidies for those who were poor but who didn't qualify for Medicaid. And then the final component, the one that we focused on, was the employer mandate.
And the employer mandate requires that large employers, those with 50 or more employees, have to provide health insurance, affordable health insurance, to their employees or pay a substantial penalty. So it's the employer mandate that we're focused on. And a concern is that instead of actually offering this coverage, employers could switch to more workers who aren't covered by the mandate. So that could be part-time workers, which the ACA defines as working less than 30 hours per week, or temporary help workers, or contract out to firms that don't that aren't affected by the mandate.
Basically, small firms.
And just to maybe put in context here why this is such a big concern, we've been hearing about job growth in the United States with wage growth sort of lagging behind. This is the sort of thing that might get in the way of sustained wage growth, correct?
Exactly. I mean, there's sort of two sides to this. On the one hand, when the ACA was passed, the idea behind the employer mandate was to help give more workers access to health insurance through their employers. After it was passed, if you remember, it was passed in 2010, we were still very much, if not officially in a recession, very much still in a, you know, kind of the labor market was depressed. And there was a lot of concern at the time that this mandate might backfire, that rather than offering workers insurance, employers would try to sidestep it because it can be expensive, particularly for low-wage workers, for whom it represents a higher share of their wage, the payment of the insurance by the employer. And so they would cut back on hours, reduce them below 30 hours per week. There was a lot of suggestive evidence that this was going on. Some of the employer groups were protesting loudly. There were lists of employers who had, allegedly cut back on the hours shortly after the bill was passed. And even some unions expressed a lot of concern that this was going to happen, that it would ruin the, as they put it, the 40-hour work week.
So are there certain types of workers who would be more likely to find themselves in this situation? You mentioned, Susan, low-income workers, but I guess I'm wondering, are there workers in certain industries who might be more prone to find their hours being cut if an employer is going to do it?
So in earlier work, we tried to be really careful in thinking about who would actually be affected by the mandate. And we showed that in most industries, the majority of people are already offered health insurance, or they're not going to be covered by the mandate. And we found that the industries with relatively high proportions of people who are going to be affected by the mandate were retail, accommodations, and the food service sectors. These are people who are working 30 to 40 hours per week, but aren't being offered health insurance right now.
So before we get to what you've actually found so far, let's talk a little bit about how you found it. And you, for one thing, as you tell us in this report, you look at the state of Hawaii. Why does Hawaii factor into this as a significant signpost?
Well, when economists try to kind of assess what the effects of a particular policy is, often we look for what we call natural experiments to get kind of an empirical handle, statistical handle on what's causing what. Because if you think about it, lots of things are going on in the economy, so we're trying to zero in on what the effects of a particular policy, in this case, the employer mandate, are on part-time employment.
And you're trying to account for variables as well.
We're trying to account for everything else that could be affecting part-time employment in the economy. Okay. So in this case, our natural experiment is Hawaii. As some of your listeners may know, Hawaii was the one state that had a mandate that was much stronger than the employer mandate in the Affordable Care Act. And it had been in effect for more than three decades. If you look at the data, employees in Hawaii are just much more likely to receive health insurance from their employers than are employees in any other state in the country. So it really was an outlier. The argument is that employees in Hawaii, employers rather in Hawaii, would really not be affected by this mandate. They've been subject to a much more stringent one for years, and they were, by and large, already offering part-time workers health insurance benefits. I won't go into the details of the statistical analysis. There's a lot of statistics. But in a nutshell, what we find is that before the mandate, before even the Great Recession, you see the level, the rates of part-time employment, and also we look very carefully at involuntary part-time employment. Those are people who want full-time jobs but can't find them. You see those moving together in Hawaii and the rest of the country. Up into the recession, they follow parallel developments during the recession, but they start to diverge after the passage of the Affordable Care Act. And they start to diverge specifically in industries where we think employers are most likely to use part-time employment. That is, in these sectors, retail that Marcus mentioned, retail, hotel, food services, which are basically restaurants, by and large, where there are already a lot of people not covered by health insurance. There's already a lot of use of part-time employment. And there's a lot of use of low hours part-time employment already. They already have kind of, many of employers in these industries use flexible scheduling practices. And we argue that it's not that hard for them to cut workers' hours by a few hours to get them below the 30-hour limit. So anyway, that's in a nutshell what we find.
And I think it's important to note that we don't find any changes in the other industries. So for Hawaii and the rest of the nation, all other industries that we don't think are going to be affected by the ACA trend smoothly with part-time work, which is reassuring that we're really identifying the effect of the ACA here.
So if we were looking for a number here of workers who have seen themselves not either been moved from full-time to part-time or maybe didn't get the full-time job that they would have wanted because they ended up instead in part-time for an employer to cut costs. Do we have a number on that?
Our estimate is about 500,000 to 1 million workers, which is about 0.5% of the wage and salary labor force.
You're right. 2 to 3 percentage points in those industries. And we should be clear that we're not saying it never happens in other industries. It's just that it's too small to detect empirically. So the magnitudes that we're finding are, they're not huge, but they're quite significant in these industries, and they amount to on the order of 0.5% of the workforce. It also kind of ties into a lot of debate and concerns over what you may have heard of is persistently high part-time employment that we were observing coming out of the recession. Part-time employment, in particular, this component that varies cyclically, the involuntary part-time employment, was not dropping as fast as we would expect it to have dropped, given where we are in the economy. And we're not alone in speculating that at least part of that is because of the, could be because of the ACA. And our findings certainly support that.
You do go on, however, to point out in this report that there is some cost-benefit analysis that an employer has to do here, that it may not be just a simple zero-sum game of if I cut my workers back to part-time, I'm going to come out ahead. There's a lot of factors here. So is this necessarily the last word on whether or not the ACA in the long term is going to mean more workers working part-time hours?
So to us, We certainly view these as the immediate short-term effects of the ACA, and we think that there are reasons to suspect that the long-term impacts could be very different than the short-term impacts. One is that there was a lot of policy uncertainty about the ACA. It was challenged in the Supreme Court on more than one occasion. The House of Representatives has voted to repeal it. The mandates were delayed twice. So it could be that employers are just kind of thinking that it might be easier to shift to part-time work instead of extend health insurance in the short run while they wait for this uncertainty to be resolved. As Sue said, it's also the case that the ACA was passed at times of high unemployment and high part-time work already. So this is, we're identifying the effects of the ACA during the Great Recession or coming out of the Great Recession. As we continue to recover from the Great Recession, compensation will hopefully rise, and part of that compensation may be health insurance for a lot of these workers who are currently being pushed to part-time work.
Right, exactly. As labor markets, we hope, will tighten, demand will increase, the economy will grow, employers are going to have to offer better compensation packages to workers in order to attract them. And many of the people who are working part-time but want full-time work, in order for them to continue, employers may likely have to increase their hours and offer health insurance.
So what do you as economists want to look at next? Maybe you want to move on to something else besides healthcare, but assuming that you want to spend some more time on this issue, what's the next thing that you think you or maybe somebody else should dive into to examine this issue of what the Affordable Care Act means for full-time, part-time workers?
Well, so one thing is that we're really focused on involuntary part-time. So does this mandate move people who want full-time jobs into part-time work? But it could also be the case that the exchanges are other options for health insurance allow people who want to be part-time but can't because they need employer-sponsored health insurance to move into part-time work, to work fewer hours if they want to raise a family or devote more time to another project. So you might expect to see a change in voluntary part-time work because of the ACA.
You know, somebody might look at our results, take a quick look at our results and say, well, 500,000 to 1 million people is big. I don't know if it's big. It's not that big relative to the rest of the economy. But they might say, well, we should do away with the mandate. The other piece that we haven't looked at yet is how many people actually did get health insurance as a consequence of the mandate. That has to be kind of part of the judgment to look at sort of the overall effects on health insurance and availability of health insurance for workers. The data are just coming out. Official statistics, national statistics have been collected. And we haven't analyzed them yet. There have been some very preliminary other surveys done privately, for example, by Kaiser, that are merely suggestive that more employers offered health insurance to their part-time workers than cut their hours. But those, they need to be, that needs to be examined with better data. So I think before we would jump to any, say, policy conclusions, one would certainly want to step back and look at the overall effect on provision of benefits and kind of weigh the pluses and the minuses, certainly at least from the workers' perspective.
Thank you both for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Susan Hausman and Marcus Dillinder are economists with the Upjohn Institute for Employment Research in Kalamazoo. They are two of the authors of a report on the potential impact of the Affordable Care Act on full and part-time employment. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans.